Today's Teisho is on case 72 in the Blue Rock Collection. Ungans, do you have them or not? Main subject. Hyakujo asked Ungan, with your mouth and lips closed, how would you say it? Ungan said, Osho, do you have them or not? Hyakujo said, my successors will be missing. Secho's verse, Osho, do you have them or not? The golden-haired lion does not crouch. In twos or threes, they go the old way. The master of Mount Taiyu snaps his fingers in vain. Today is the final day of our May-June session, and I want to thank everybody for doing such a wonderful job, and especially I want to thank people for doing such a good job this morning, when I know that many of you are tired, your bodies are tired and your minds are tired, and you've made really excellent effort and excellent progress at this session. There's not a single person here who hasn't really made great strides, and it's really just a pure pleasure to practice with each of you. So good work, and we do have the rest of the day, and something can still be accomplished, even though it is day five and probably your legs are tired and your back is tired and your mind is tired, and that's natural. But please realize that even though you feel tired, and even though you might feel a little, dim-witted or dull-witted, it's probably very far from the truth. Very far from the truth. That feeling of being dim-witted or dull-witted, is something that we don't always understand correctly. When we think of a desirable mental state, we think of what we might call lucid mind, and that lucid mind is the mind you have like when you're doing math problems, right? Or when you're thinking in sentences. I have a friend of mine who's he really is a very brilliant person. And when he speaks, you can just see him composing sentences, these graceful, it's like he's at his word processor, he's talking to his class, he's lecturing. And you almost see him, it's like he'll say something, it's almost like, period. Blah, 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 period. New paragraph, And it's like, that's amazing, he's just amazing. And when I talk, it's like, it's the thing. He's so lucid, he also comes to faculty meetings. And again, people will stumble around with what they mean. They'll try to make a point, and they work their way toward the point. They say, "Well, I don't know if I like this idea." Blah 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 blah. And they finally get to what they really meant to say. They sort of just, but he's always very lucid. He said, "It seems to me," and then he'll lay it all out in these beautiful sentences. He's just a model of lucidity. So we envy that kind of mind, and yet that kind of mind is really it's very hard to achieve. Believe me, it's not just like a gift. That person I'm talking about has worked his whole life strenuously to be able to do that. You know, if you have to write anything, you know it takes great intelligence and care and application to achieve that kind of lucidity. You know, and often lucidity means, you know, everything's in its proper place, right? It's like everything's where it should be, and you're more or less going along as you expect to go along, you know. So with math, you know, when you do a math problem, there might be some uncertainty about, you know, how to work the problem through. But you don't have to invent math all over again. It's all laid out for you, you know. There are people who are like very advanced mathematicians who actually invent mathematics, you know. They think about new forms of math but most people just, you know, if you're like me, you're just adding and subtracting. Somebody else figured out how to do this, you know. So I can feel very lucid if I'm balancing my checkbook or I'm trying to calculate some administrative detail, you know. And what I'm doing is I'm reasserting my control over things, and I'm putting everything in familiar, like, pigeonholes, right? And good communication can be like that too, you know, where you take things and make them very, very easy for people to follow. And that means putting things in familiar ways, even if they're somewhat unfamiliar, you know. And this is really an art, and it's very, very hard to achieve, and something worthy of respect, you know. I'm not at all criticizing lucidity. But there's something about lucidity that's very limiting, you know. It seems to me like, what we want to have is a lucid mind, and what we don't want to have is like to be dull-witted or dim-witted, right? And that is a feeling you get where your mind just, it's like there's a block of cement between your ears, you know? Yeah? Do you ever get that feeling? And you may have it today, you know, where, you know, you're just looking at rice in a bowl and it's like there's just this block of cement between your ears, you know? And you could think, this, God, how I've become stupid. Stupid. But actually, you know, this state of mind is highly regarded, you know. It's a different kind of intelligence. It's a different kind of intelligence. It's not a discriminating intellect, but you are highly intelligent, and you're processing information in a different. It's like you're using circuitry that's a little unfamiliar, so you might feel uneasy about it. You know, when you process information, you can go through the language parts of your brain, you know. So when you process information, you can the brain can send the inputs through the language units, you know, and through certain kinds of memory units, you know. And see, I say, you know, instead of period, new paragraph. Right? So, but you're getting in, you know, inputs can be sent through the language part of the brain, and that's got culture, it's got all this stuff. And so, you know, what's going to get stored away is going to be very conventional. It's going to be pretty much what everybody already thinks, you know. But it is possible, and even like, you know, brain scientists will tell you, it's possible to process information without sending it through the language parts of the brain. It really is. And so you can process information in this different way, which doesn't go, you know, use culture and language to screen out information. And actually, we do use this part of our brains all the time, but we don't pay much attention to it. You know, we make a lot of decisions in our lives, and a lot of actions occur without our consciously reasoning them through. You know, all the time we make gut distinctions. You know, we have gut reactions, or we make quick judgments. And basically, they're often very accurate. In fact, you know, psychologists have done studies of these snap judgments and found they're highly accurate. It's fascinating, because you think it would be much better to deliberate carefully and logically. And there have been a number of studies that say actually people make worse decisions when they sit there and reflect and reflect and reflect. Isn't that interesting? That kind of analysis is important in certain contexts, but there's a lot of evidence that says you have a bigger brain that can actually take in more information, and the snap judgment is sort of tapping into that. You know, it's something our culture has only begun to appreciate. You know, when we reflect in a lucid mode, as I say, you know, you're just putting everything back into a familiar category. And often this means telling familiar stories, right? Telling familiar stories. And so, years ago, I had this experience where it was one of the most difficult moments in my life as an English professor, which is not, you know, full of difficult moments, I have to tell you the truth. It's not like being a soldier, a frontline soldier, or, the problems of English professors are pretty small potatoes in this world. But anyway, you know, it's just true. I mean, people have real problems that English professors don't, you know, really. Or not those, they have problems, but not real world problems, they have psychological problems, I guess, you know. So the thing is that, I wrote an article, I've talked about this before, but I wrote this article, and I knew it would be sort of controversial, because it said some things that weren't typical. And it got into print, and then about a year later I opened up a magazine and I saw an article by a colleague of mine, somebody I quote unquote thought was my friend, right? and I noticed that she refers to my work right in the front of the article, and I thought, oh, her name is Min, actually, she's from mainland China, and Min wrote this article about me, and I saw her citing, and I didn't read it at the time. I thought, oh, that's great. She's probably using my work. And later, I got home and I opened it up, and she just like took out a meat axe and chopped me to pieces. And you know, when an event like that happens, there's so many ways you can respond, right? I mean, you can say, you want to tell a story that will make this significant, right? And you tend to reach for like familiar, familiar stories, patterns of stories. So one story is like good guy versus bad guy, right? You know, most movies work this way, and TV, right? It's very stereotypical thinking. So in a movie, and even more on a TV, they always signal at some point who's the bad guy, right? He has to look a certain way, or he'll do something which makes it, you get the signal, oh, he's the bad guy, right? You know, it's like kicking a baby or something. It's like, you know, oh my God, you know, he's clearly a bad man. He's the one who has to die in this movie, right? You know, or he's doing all these terrible things, and at the end the hero will kill him, right? So this is the average way of thinking about things in popular culture. It's the this is the narrative, right? So, you know, when somebody attacks you in print, you know, often when people are hurt, when life has given us a setback, we tend to go back to like these basic formulas, you know, including on the cushion, right? We go back to the basic formula, right? So, you know, it's basically, you open this article and you're thinking, oh, she, my old friend Min, you know, I wonder what wonderful insights she has to offer about my ideas. You know, what? You know, you know, so, you know, then you could say, oh, she's a bad person. She's just a bad, I thought she was a good person, but she's a bad person, right? You know, so that's one way to put it. You know. And, you know, and you know, there's a million ways to tell a story like this, you know. You could say, you know, well, you know, the truth, the reason she's attacking me is because she's a backward person. You know, she's just basically backward in her thinking, and I'm the new. I'm the artist. I'm the cutting edge, see? I'm the one who's opening the future. She's in the past, see? So it's always the case, isn't it, that whenever anybody has a new idea, people try to block them. You know, isn't it always the case that the real thinkers get trampled on? And isn't it the case that I'm really the real thinker here? See how this works? You know? And she's just in the dark ages, basically. And I'm bringing the light. You know? See? And it all begins to make sense, right? Right? And you know, or you could say, you know, well, she went to Princeton. Isn't this how it always works? You know, she went to Princeton, and I went to the University of Washington. You know, this is the Ivy League contempt for the working class intellectual. You know? Here I am, a man of the people, right? Trying to fight for the little guy. And here's this Ivy League snob, you know, trying to grind me down. You know? Right? Typical, you know, ivory tower egghead, you know, ivory tower egghead, you know, and I'm the salt of the earth. You know. So, you know, we all tend to do this, right? You know, especially if we're injured, you know, we want to, this is why when people get into an argument, it can excel, you know. Everybody tries to get the last word. What they're really fighting for is their self-esteem, and they're fighting for their story about themselves. Everybody wants to have a story about himself or herself in which, you know, I'm the hero of this. It's clear, you know, I'm the hero of this story, right? And everybody in my life is a supporting character, right? This is very much a human way of thinking, right? I'm the hero of my story, and everybody, these are all the supporting characters. Now, you know, every once in a while you realize in your relationship with somebody that they see you as a supporting character. For example, I'm continuously surprised that my wife thinks I'm the second banana in our relationship. I think she clearly sees me as one of the supporting characters. So at the end of the show, it's going to be the Barbara Sutman show, right? And as her husband, Kirk, right? And fine, they'll have all the cast of characters, and as her husband, Kirk, you know? Starring Barbara. Oh, I understand. I'm just a supporting character. Now it's all clear to me. Okay. So, basically, everybody does this. You know, this is part of being a human being, is to narrate our experience. But please notice that all of these narratives are, they're self-serving, right? And there's a kind of desperation to all of them, right? It's like when we're dealt a blow or a setback, you know, we're trying to retool our story to accommodate this. And so that we can rewrite it and say, and then, you know, the hero realized, you know, and went on to be the hero he really was, you know, and I think everybody does this on some level. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm generalizing, but I think this is often the case. And this is all small mind thinking. This is little mind thinking. This is what the little mind does so well. It's very hard, however, to learn anything new when this is your, you know, way of operating. It's very hard because your stories are not, you know, you didn't write these stories. You inherited them from other people. And that you are writing stories for an audience, right? It's usually a very conventional audience, right? The stories are for the people you regard as important. You learn to tell these stories from those people, and you learn the stories from those people, and you tell them with them, with their faces in your mind, right? You know. So basically, it's very hard to learn anything new, and it's going to be a self-cent. It's not evil, you know. You have to understand, like, the desperation, I think, of people. You know, people would rather die than not be thought well of. You know, this is just an elementary human lesson. That it's vitally important. Self-respect is more important, I think, than anything else for humans. It's more important than wealth. It's the quest for wealth and power, I think, are just forms of trying to get self-respect. You know, and so there's this incredibly strong motivation. It doesn't take long to see that there are real problems with this. You can't, it's hard to learn new things because you're always putting everything in these stereotypical narrative structures, you know. Bad guy versus good guy, working class hero, you know. There's another way to live, which actually is this big mind. You know, Zen practice is about learning to tap into big mind. And actually, big mind doesn't have the self at the center of it, and it doesn't have this narrative structure. You know, it's a different kind of consciousness. It really is. You know, when you're sitting in on the cushion and you're watching your breath, you're really watching the breath. You know, what can often happen is that you might say look into your mind, and you realize that there's nothing there, it's just blank. And one of the things that has disappeared in that case is like this constant self, the watcher. You know, usually there's like an audience. There's usually an audience for the me, right? I'm always performing for my audience. I may not be able to. Earlier in the session, I was talking about this rather terrible movie I saw recently on my exercise bike. It was on cable TV. And it was about a guy who goes to a psychiatrist and he has a fantasy, even though he's kind of a street person, that he's a star and that he's got an audience. And everything he does is always directed towards the attention of his audience. And he keeps telling his psychiatrist, well, my audience wouldn't like it if I wound up like that. I've got to do something special. And he's constantly referring to this audience that doesn't exist, but as he walks around, he's visualizing himself as being watched by an audience. This is actually very human, right? This is ordinary consciousness, I think. Very, very, this is it. This is or so every once in a while, it becomes possible when we sit on the cushion for, you know, the audience to disappear. And when the audience disappears, so does the star of the show. And there's just this, there's a kind of consciousness without object, you know? And it's not self-centered awareness, it's awareness without object. And in fact, you know, it's actually awareness without source. There was a French thinker, you know, whose name was Descartes. If you decide to take a Western philosophy course, you will not escape without reading Monsieur Descartes. And Descartes says, you know, he is famous for the saying, I think, therefore I am. He said, how do I know I exist? Because I think. But actually, you know, he wasn't a meditator. He actually did observe the mind. Descartes really tried to do something like meditation. But if you, but he's really just describing ordinary consciousness. If you sit on the cushion and you enter samadhi, there's not I think, there's just awareness. There's not necessarily an I, just pure awareness. There's not necessarily an object, and there's not necessarily a subject. You know, there's just pure awareness. See, and that's fascinating, right? I think. You sit on the cushion, and on the third day of a session, you look in your mind, and there's no thinker, and there's no object, but there's awareness. See, that I just think is amazing. And that's really like one of the foundations of Zen meditation. Objectless, subjectless awareness. You know. And it's there, you know. Okay. So another aspect of this kind of consciousness, big mind consciousness, is that, big mind consciousness can have an object. And it can even be aware of the self, but it doesn't, that's not the center of consciousness. The center has shifted, you know. The self comes in and it goes out. Self comes in and it goes out. It comes and it goes away, but consciousness remains present even when the self is gone, even when self-awareness is gone. Consciousness remains present even when the object is gone. That's fascinating. And then the other thing is that, when you're really in the moment, if you're really, realistically, you're sitting on the cushion, it's day 5 of the session, it's minute number 22, right? You're thinking, ring the bell, right? Usually, right? Please ring the bell. It must be the end of the period. But every once in a while you have a sit where you sit on the cushion and you're just thinking, this is fantastic. And the sit starts and you think, oh boy, here comes the pain, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, hey, and then just, you're cruising, you know, it's beautiful. And then the bell rings, it's like, huh, already? Right? You know, if sooner or later, I'm sure you've had a sit like that, or I promise you will, where it's just like, and during that period, you know, there's just, in this will deepen and deepen, you know, there's just no time. Or it's like time exists on one level, and on the other, there's just like this dimension that has no time. You know, there's no tomorrow, there's no yesterday. See, this is very much the state of mind people enter in Sesshin. You know, you come to Sesshin, and day one, it's like you drag all of this stuff in from your life, right? You have all these dreams and aspirations. By about day 3, it's possible to be in this consciousness which has, you know, no content, and no thinker, and often no thoughts. Yeah? And it's also possible to be in this moment that has no time. This is something, this is not religion, and this is not metaphysics, and it's not philosophy. If you haven't had these experiences, you will. And they'll be clear, they'll be direct, and obvious, as self-evident as anything else, you know. It's a different form of, a different way of experiencing the world. And it is just pure presentness in this moment. And you know, as the session ends, people begin to start flipping back into like the time-conscious mind. The little mind is like a time-conscious mind, right? It's thinking past and present, here's what happened, here's what I want to have happen, and the clock starts ticking. For a little while in a session, it's like there's no watch, there's no clock, you know. The sun is bright, the sun is dark, you vaguely know it's the end of the day, you vaguely know it's the beginning of the day. But if you're really in samadhi, time is not important, you know. As we're going out the door, you know, time comes back, you know. So this consciousness is real, it really exists. What we're learning to do at Sesshin is to experience the world in this other way, activating big mind. And other things happen when you're in this state of mind. I mean, you often find that you can you're happier. You often find a kind of energy, kind of joy. You often find a deeper sense of connection. You know, it's amazing to me how many people, have experiences during Sesshin where they realize how much they love someone or miss someone or how much they're going to, they'll often leave Sesshin and say, I'm going to call my brother, I'm going to do this. People often think of Zen as leaving the world behind, but really it's the little mind that leaves the world behind. You know, it's the little mind that sort of creates these screens or these walls between ourselves and the world. It's like we've got to make our story stick, even if it means lying about a lot of things. And humans do this all the time. Once we construct our story, we're going to try to stick with it as long as we can, even if it means we're going to hide a lot of information, you know, under the rug. And big mind is a different kind of mind. It's much more open. And in a big mind, you can really see a lot of the things you just couldn't bring yourself to see when you're in little mind. So that's what Zen is about. That's what you've been doing for 5 days, is experiencing the power of this big mind. And I hope you've had a little taste of it here. This koan is really about that. You know, Yakujo is Baijiang. Okay, Baijiang asked Ungan, with your mouth and lips closed, how would you say it? See, this is like saying, I want you to speak without using your lips. See? And that's just a classic koan. If you want to understand like a classic koan, this is it. Because immediately, you know, if I say, please speak, but don't use your lips, you know, immediately the little mind says, well, that's impossible, right? That's impossible. That's logically impossible, right? And so, basically that's where it stops, right? A koan like this pitches you something that shuts your small mind down. You just sit there and, you can try to think it through. You can get mad. You can get frustrated. You can beat yourself and say, oh, I'll never amount to anything in Zen. I knew I was a bum, you know. You can do all these different things. This is your karma. This is the cleaning up karma phase of Zen practice. So the koan says, basically, I want you to do something that your little mind says can't be done. I want you to see something your little mind says doesn't exist. I want you to, and so on. In other words, the little mind lives by these fantasies, makes these stories stick, you know. And now I want you to experience something that isn't in those stories. Right? And so basically, little mind says, oh, there's no way, can't do it, can't be done. And you sit on the cushion and you go, and then you encounter your karma, you know, which is, can be a range of things, you know. It can be Zen stinks, it can be I wish I were out of here, it can be I'll never amount to anything, it can be, you know, I hate myself, I hate everybody in the room, whatever, you know. It can be the whole thing. And probably, you know, your mind ranges through all of this stuff, but if you keep coming back to your breath or you keep coming back to mu, your mind goes deeper, 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 deeper. And as sooner or later, you will enter, even if it's just for a few minutes in any particular day, you'll enter this state where the mind is empty, blank. It's experienced as empty and blank, right? And this is a consciousness without object and subject, right? Just pure awareness. And basically, you just stay there in that state, and that mind is capable of processing the question. And the question was written by these Chinese monks 1200 years ago, who understood the human mind with incredible clarity, or incredible penetration, or incredible depth. And basically, they understood how to activate that big mind. And so, you know, your little mind saying, I can't speak without using my lips, and what the koan is really saying is, act from your big mind. And a koan, as I've said before, is, you know, your koan practice always requires the same thing from everybody. Every koan, the method for each koan is always the same. It's just enter Ushin, enter blank mind, and then just work with the turning phrase, or there's usually in a koan, there's a phrase you keep repeating on your out-breath. So if there's a koan that goes, Nansen cuts a cat in two. So you just say, cuts in two, cuts in two, cuts in two. And this is like this koan sinks down into your consciousness. And it begins to produce a transformation. And all this stuff can come out, you know. All this karmic stuff can come out. But you just keep coming back to the blankness and working it through. Now, if you don't come back to the blankness, if you don't come back to that blankness, eventually you're going to get lost in all of this junk. And you've got to make make a point out of coming back to the blankness, back to that darkness, over and over. Now, you know, when you're doing this properly, you don't feel lucid. You don't feel lucid. You feel like there's a stone between your ears, right? You feel stupid or dull-witted. But don't be deceived. This is a highly intelligent state. This state of dull-wittedness means you're just not drawing on the language centers of your mind. You're processing the information in a different way. And of course, part of the problem is we don't trust that big mind. So in the presence of anomalies, we start generating ideas. You know, we just start producing all this stuff nervously, trying to make the problem go away or put it in the right story. And basically, what we need is not a better story. What we need is to stop trying to make a story out of things like our lives, which are not stories. And we need to just be present in the moment, whatever it might be. You know, so that's that state of dullness that you might be feeling is, don't be deceived. This is like something you had to work very hard to achieve. And if you live the Zen life, you're going to spend a lot of time there. It's heaven. It's heaven. It's not stupidity. It's receptivity. It's receptivity. It's a bigger mind, you know. I'm not going to go on much longer, but there was a famous Japanese Zen master named Soyen Shaku Roshi. And a little more than a century ago, there was an American who had this idea of getting religious leaders from all over the world to come to one place. And he thought, if all these religious leaders can talk to each other, maybe we'll see we have a lot in common and we could learn from each other. So people from the Western religious traditions came, some great Indians, Swamis came, Muslim, you know, and also a few Buddhists came. And the Soyen Shaku was one of the speakers, and the previous speaker was an Indian philosopher and guru. And he gave this brilliant talk. I mean, everybody in the room was going, oh, that is so smart. You know, and he was using Schopenhauer and blah, blah, blah. And so then Soyen Shaku had to speak, and And nobody really understood what he was talking about, a little bit like Bodhidharma. Because he started his talk by saying, the problem with modern people is they don't know how to be dumbfounded. And everybody burst into laughter. They thought it was a translation mistake. It would be like saying, the problem with modern people is they don't know how to be blockheaded. Nobody really got it, you know. But what he was trying to communicate is the superiority of big mind. The feeling, you might have a feeling like uneasiness about it. But, you know, at the end of being, if you're in that blockheaded state for a little while, you're going to feel, at the end of it, you're going to feel really good. And you're going to be more open. And you're going to have more energy. Even, you might be a little tired now, but in a few days, you're going to feel much better for having done this. And basically, it's going to change, I think, if you do this often, change your life, you know. Because our problem, generally speaking, is that we're too afraid, and we're too closed up, and we live two lives that are just too small. And we don't have to live that way. We don't have to. We can live a different kind of life, a bigger life, you know. A life that has, we say in Zen, no birth and no death. You know, it's not in heaven. It's right here now if you experience the world through big mind. So, it's not impossible to speak without using your lips. It just requires a change of consciousness. Hyakujo asks Ungan, with your mouth and lips closed, how would you say it? See, now Ungan he's trapped in a discriminating mind. He says, well, you have a mouth and lips. See? Well, you have a mouth and lips. See, he's not entering big mind. He's trying to argue his way out of the situation, right? So you have a mouth. It's like, look at the contradiction in your own position, right? And Hyakujo says, oh well, you know, I'm not going to have any Dharma successors because you're not in big mind. That's basically what he says. And that's the end of the call. But fortunately, Ungan didn't stop there. He learned how to enter big mind, and his life was quite wonderful. We have a little time left to be in big mind. And even if you feel tired, being tired is not the end of the world. Often when we're tired, we're more receptive, greater receptivity, greater openness, greater spontaneity. And the feeling that, you know, the thoughts just aren't coming, believe me, that's the most wonderful thing in the world, you know. If you're just sitting there blankly, looking at a bowl of rice, this is, if you stay there long enough, if you go back to that state long enough, you realize how dynamic and alive it really is, versus the other state, you know, where it's like, little mind isn't dynamic and alive a lot of the time. It's fearful, it's a closed up, thinks in stereotypes, it thinks in, the tired, old, threadbare cliches, you know. So it might not be familiar with the state now, but if you keep coming back there, you feel the way about it that I do, which is that this is it's like the heaven itself. So, Sesho's verse, Osho. Osho is like priest. Do you have them or not? You know, the golden-haired lion does not crouch. You know, Baijiang is like a golden-haired lion. He's not going to take the bait. He's not going to get caught up in a philosophical debate. In twos and threes, they go the old way. The master of Taiyu snaps his fingers in vain. So, Hyakujo is trying to help Ungan wake up, but Ungan is It's not ready yet, but it's going to happen.